From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in a part of Rochester, a place that is home to some of the most poverty in the city. But this is also part of Rochester with a new spirit. There is abundant fresh food, quality green space, education for sustainable living, even reduced energy costs. There's a zip line across the Genesee River. The garden aerial makes the gorge even more spectacular. There's job training happening on a regular basis, jobs for the green industry. New trees are being planted. There's butterfly bushes, signs with information about the importance of biodiversity. And with all of these assets, these struggling neighborhoods are sure to see better days. Now, here's the problem as some people see it. We've been hearing about these ideas for years now. It's part of Greentopia and the so-called Eco District of Rochester. But where is everything? What's happening next? This hour, we've got some answers for you, and we're going to tell you about some of the steps being taken over the next year, starting with on Friday of this week. So there is a lot going on, and our guests for the hour are going to tell you all about it. Lisa Barron is a board chair for Greentopia. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Evan. Thank you.
Rachel Walsh is Eco District Program Director at Greentopia. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
And Pamela Reed Sanchez is President and CEO of the Seneca Park Zoo Society, which makes me want to ask, what are you doing here? I mean, hello. Welcome.
Nice to see you, Evan.
Yeah. Tell us about the partnership. Why they wanted to invite you here.
Well, we are partners with the Greentopia in Arbor Day and other efforts to bring pollinators back down to the river area. We've been working in monarch habitat restoration for many years and have really expanded our program tremendously, and we're excited to partner and get that news out. We're also doing a lot with urban ecology. It's not just what we do on the zoo campus, but the outreach that we're doing in the community that I'm here to talk about.
And over the next hour, we will talk about workforce development programs. We're going to talk about the Eco District, what we can expect to see over the next year. How does this tie in to Rock the Riverway? We'll talk about that. We'll talk about if we're ever getting a zipline. I want the zipline. So there's a lot to discuss, but let's be more immediate. Friday at noon, you got an event that coincides with Arbor Day. What's going on Friday?
So on Friday, we are installing a pollinator pathway in High Falls. It will start at the corner of Mill and Brown Street and run about a 400-foot stretch up to a historic steel structure. We are working with many partners. We are working with RG&E and Seneca Park Zoo with a whole host of volunteers from all around the High Falls area. We'll be installing flowering trees and flowering bushes and a custom pollinator mix that Seneca Park Zoo has put together that I'm sure Pamela will want to tell you more about. But it's the first project of the Eco District. So we really are excited to kick off the formal Eco District projects with a really pretty, I like that it's pretty, but it's pretty and it's biodiverse and it's inclusive. So we're really excited to have this be the first project of the Eco District.
Okay, so Friday at noon, can people be there? Ribbon cutting's going on for the pollinator pathway?
Yep, we're having a ribbon cutting right at noon if you want to stop by and see all the work that's being done in that area and pick our brains a little more about what's happening in the next year.
And you call it a pollinator pathway, and Pamela brought it up too. If this works, if this is a long-term success, what does it look like, Rachel?
It looks a little bit wilder than I think what most people think of when they think of landscaping. So typically when you see a garden, it's very manicured, it's very controlled. This is a naturalized habitat. It's a mix of perennial wildflowers and grasses because the ground habitat is just as important as the flowers. And so what you're going to see is an area that looks a little bit more wilder is the best way I can describe it. It'll be beautiful and it'll be lush and full, but it won't have that manicured look, which is one of the reasons we put do not mow signs in, so that people know specifically this is not to be mowed over. It's intentionally overgrown to create these habitats for species that are needed in the urban areas.
And the pollinator role, tell us about the importance there, Pamela.
Well, our agriculture depends on it. This region is really in need of the bees, the wild bees, as well as the birds and the monarchs and other butterflies. And we don't realize how much they use the corridors of the city to to go from one place to another to migrate. And if they are in search of food, they need to be able to find it in between their stops over. So to invite the native species back. And Rachel mentioned this is a native pollinator mix that Seneca Park Zoo Society has created with a partner that we have, a seed distributor. This is meant to be native seed would work between Buffalo and Syracuse, essentially. It's that specific to this region. And you want the original, the native plants to be here for the species that need them. For a while, we were creating butterfly beltway gardens that were very pretty and colorful, but weren't necessarily using native plants. And so if the native food isn't here for the pollinators, then we're not really achieving the mission. So we've moved to doing more naturalized habitats restoration. There's a mega garden that we have at Thousand Acre Swamp on Nature Conservancy property out in Penfield. But also we have a project with the Department of Transportation that covers 6 miles of 390 around Mount Morris. And we do native pollinator habitats there as well. And Rachel's right. It does look a little messy. And sometimes people say, well, shouldn't it be mowed? But this is what's necessary for wildlife. And really, it's beautiful. Absolutely stunningly beautiful and natural. And if you're quiet and you look at it for a while, you begin to see so many different creatures using the ground and using the flowers. Each space in it is just teeming with biodiversity.
All right, so now let's broaden the view. And when you hear the term eco district, tell us where we're talking about in Rochester when we say eco district.
Sure. The eco district is basically a 322-acre newly defined neighborhood directly centered on High Falls. So it runs from in between the two stadiums on Oak Street over to North Clinton, down to the Andrew Street Bridge in downtown, and up to Smith Street. And in case all of you don't have the map memorized quite as well as I do, it's essentially just the High Falls area drawn out about 3 blocks on each side. So this is our way to attempt to reconnect both the east and the west sides of the gorge, because right now when people think of High Falls, it's really strictly sort of just the historic district. So this is our way of bringing the entire neighborhood together, the greater High Falls neighborhood, to work together towards being more sustainable.
Listeners, if you've got questions or comments, especially as we talk about this particular part of Rochester, what you'd like to see there, or questions about the Eco District and these programs and these ideas, the vision that they have there, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Lisa, I open the hour with this vision for what it could be, you know, sort of culling ideas from what I've read on Greentopia over the years, to the website, to the recent writings, even to Rock the Riverway. Was that a fair vision for what this could actually be happening here? Is that too ambitious?
Well, you know, dream big, Evan, or go home. that's my motto. And, you know, Rochester is a city teeming with talent and ambition and vision. We've had so many startups coming out of this city that have, and I kind of view this as a startup, you know, a not-for-profit startup, but a startup nonetheless. And it's a vision that raises Rochester up in its attitude about itself and about its city. And I think we kind of need that shot in the arm right now.
Do you hear from people who are impatient is probably good. It means they like the vision, but they're wondering, when are we going to see something happen? What's the message for those people?
Right. So I think Rock the Riverway could be the message and the means to the end. So that is the governor was in town in February, and both the governor and the mayor announced the Rock the Riverway program. I think it's been on your program and been discussed. And so that is a $50 million check to be written to the city for riverfront development. But the advisory board that's been selected is maybe not the usual suspects. It's got a very eclectic mix of individuals on the board that have been reaching out publicly, not only at organized meetings, but actually going to out to the community to sit in on community meetings to find out people's opinions about how they want to see the money spent, how they want to engage with the river. And one of the things that's been rising to the top at all of these public meetings is the need for education about the environment, about the ecology, about the river, about resources, and the impact that an urban environment has on such an invaluable resource like a river. So I think the advisory board has been hearing this at every meeting, and I think it's an important, and it's not laid out specifically in any of the Rock the Riverway plans right now. So I think it's important to have this conversation about creating this potential for education about the waterway.
Well, let me turn to Rachel, who's the program director of the Eco District at Greentopia. So let's hit this from a couple different ways. Did you think the vision that I laid out at the top, is that fair? I mean, when people say, what's this, the end goal here of an eco district? What are you really aiming to do? I tried to draw up this vision of, you know, something that's happening in the areas where there are some of the poorest neighborhoods in the city that might benefit in various ways. We'll talk about job training and other things coming up here. But what is the end goal? If things go the way you want with an eco district, who benefits most and what's the mission of it?
The end goal is for High Falls to become a resilient neighborhood. So the narrative around High Falls that we've all heard for many, many years is that we keep trying. We keep throwing money at it, and it keeps not working. It keeps going through these ebb and flows of we have good years and bad years. And the idea is, how do we work with our stakeholders and design a neighborhood that will be stable and resilient throughout the many ebbs and flows of what's happening in Rochester? And really, how is that going to impact the neighborhoods around High Falls that have such high levels of poverty? So we really believe that by creating this resilient center core, that will radiate to the nearby neighborhoods with more job opportunities and just a better quality of life in this area. And one of the reasons we chose the Eco District framework is that for us to be an Eco District, to be a certified Eco District, we have to define as stakeholders what we mean by equity, resilience, and climate protection. Because we've agreed as a group that those three things will be a priority going forward. So when you talk about how does this impact people in poverty, it means when we do development in High Falls and when we work together as a group, equity is at the forefront of the conversation, not something that sneaks in at a public comment later. So I really believe that by getting everyone on the same page and by breaking down these silos and working together, we can create a High Falls that lasts for the next 100 years and is amenable and is interesting, and it's not sort of gone by the whims of whatever development is coming in at the time.
It's a big mission, and as Lisa says, maybe Rock the Riverway and that part of that $50 million is a means to getting it done. Do you agree?
Yeah. One of the things I like to say recently is that for the past couple years, we've been the crazy people at the end of the river with this $80 million project. That was the most expensive thing anyone was putting forward. Now the city came out with a $500 million project, and we're sort of the attainable side end of that. So suddenly we're not the craziest people with the largest price tag anymore, which is a nice shift, and hopefully that works to sort of seed the future of the eco district in a meaningful way.
And so this is important because you're right, $80 million, big vision, a tough goal to reach, certainly not impossible, but tough to get there. What do you say to the people who say, this is a big vision, we've been hearing for it, when are you going to do something?
I think we're doing things behind the scenes and we're doing projects on the ground. But, you know, we have Greentopia and the Community Design Center of Rochester are always bringing mayors in from other cities. And the one thing they say is timing is everything. You know, people have these ideas and they sit and timing is everything. And as much as we would have loved to see these things happen 5 years ago, it wasn't the right time. And we believe that now it is. So as much as this is a big goal and it's always been a big goal, the timing is better now than it's ever been. So.
And are you excited about Friday to be able to look to the community and say, this is happening now?
I'm very excited about Friday. This has been a little pet project on my to-do list for about a year and a half. So the fact that we got the money from DEC to do a two-year tree planting project. So that gave us the funding, and then the partners really just fell in and everybody's really excited. And it's nice to see a really tangible project happening in such a short time frame.
Pamela, how do you see, and from the perspective of the Seneca Park Zoo Society, how do you see Rock the Riverway and how it intersects with some of what we're talking about today?
Well, you know, we've been active in the health, looking at the health of the Genesee River for a number of years and being active with endangered species there, helping to you know, reintroduced North American river otters 20 years ago and beginning to help with reintroducing lake sturgeon in the early 2000s and then doing biodiversity assessments. But our mission right now as relates to Rock the Riverway is to be a part of the conversation and part of solving the problem of how do we improve the environmental literacy in this region. You know, we talk a lot about recreational opportunities around the river, and we talk some about workforce development and what that means and neighborhood resiliency. But the conversation about environmental literacy has not been put forward. And when you have an asset like the Genesee River, you have to educate people to understand the importance of that asset, not just from a recreational standpoint and a historical standpoint, but what it means for our region as an economic asset and the environment. So my interest is being a part of the conversation about how do we create that? How do we create an informal education space for multi-generational learning, for families to come to have a great time and experience nature and begin to understand what urban ecology is? Because once we raise the environmental literacy of the community, then we've got more people advocating for the environment and for clean air and clean water that we all will benefit from. And then we have more people who are being environmental stewards, who are living more sustainably, who are reducing their use of plastic, who say, I don't need a straw with my Coca-Cola. It so sounds like simple things, but that's the kind of conversation that we need to bring as part of this project, which I am hopeful that the Zoo Society can be at the table with.
Yeah,
and Lisa and I think are on the same page with that.
I agree with Pamela. You care for the things that you know and understand. That is the bottom line. And you know, it's for so long we have turned our backs to the Genesee River. We've polluted the Genesee River. We've misunderstood how to care for the Genesee River. And environmental literacy is, you can build all of these wonderful things, recreational opportunities, access to the river, but if people don't understand the river, they don't understand the ecology, they don't understand the gorge, they're still going to be throwing their paper cups into the water. You know, it's just, you need that component.
I want to make sure that I understand something, though, because when you talk about that kind of education, and to Pamela's point, even the small things, you know, thinking about our plastic usage on a daily basis, thinking about what is going into the river, et cetera, are you aiming that education at people who are living in this area, which, again, the Eco District is roughly the heart of High Falls, you know, a little bit out along the edges, which includes some neighborhoods that are among the most poverty stricken neighborhoods in Rochester. Are you aiming at the people who live there? You mean the people you want to attract down there to the scene? You want families to be there? You want people to spend more time there? Who are you aiming at here? Pamela?
Well, for the Zoo Society, it's our entire region. Whether they're coming to Greentopia or they're using other spaces along the river, whether they're coming to the zoo, the Port of Charlotte, we want to be able to have people understand that they can play an active role in being a conservationist and in making our region healthier.
Okay. Rachel?
Yeah. I mean, again, we have a targeted approach because we're working within the Eco District. So we are focusing our efforts specifically on the Eco District, but we also recognize that the river is a connective force through the whole city. So anytime we can advocate for better sustainable practices, we will. But most of our effort is placed here.
All right. Yeah, go ahead, Lisa.
Yeah. And I would just emphasize, I mean, we're not just talking K through 12. We're talking, you know, as Pamela said, multi-generational. We want to engage adults and small businesses, large businesses in this education effort.
All right, we're talking about the Eco District, an update on what you can expect there, and our guests are telling us about that. And if you've got questions or comments, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. Rhonda wants to know, how will this affect people who may have allergies to the wild plants? Nature is great, always, but what about allergies? Silence.
Uh-oh. I mean, it's, I guess I'll tell this little story. When we were doing community outreach for the Eco District, you know, our goal is we believe that pollinators are important, fresh food is important. And when we did some outreach, I had a lot of pushback for things like allergies and bees. And so it becomes another education piece that it's kind of tough. You might have to sneeze a little because ultimately the urban ecology is so important. And if we don't get these pollinators back, we'll lose our food, we'll lose our flowering trees. And nobody wants to live in a sterile world where our pollinators aren't functioning. So I don't have a good answer for that. I just have pollinators are too important to not prioritize.
Fair enough, everyone? You want to agree with that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Good answer.
I mean, look, I would say to Rhonda, just based on previous conversations about allergies, kids in the country don't really have allergies. And you know, when we grow up in sort of sterile urban environments, we have more allergies because we're not used to nature. So who knows? Maybe down the line, this will help actually mitigate allergies or make people more resistant. So maybe that's the optimistic viewpoint, but thank you, Rhonda, for that. And Tim just wanted to know to make sure we understand again what exactly the eco district is, because Rachel was using some language earlier. But to become an official eco district, you know, it's not just sort of a nebulous term created; it's an actual sort of sanctioned thing.
Yeah, to get into the weeds a little bit on this, yeah. There's a certifying board out of Portland, which is ecodistricts.org. So we are currently a registered eco district. We were one of the first 11 to register to become certified. And then the certification process is a three-step basically pathway to becoming a certified eco district, and then we have to keep our certification with 2 years. Every 2 years, we have to show our benchmarks of what we're doing. So it is a rigorous sort of certification process. It does cost money. It fits somewhere in between. It's similar to LEED neighborhood development, but a little bit less rigid. LEED is pretty rigid in its outcomes. One of the nice things about the eco district model is it's a little bit more flexible, that each eco district can sort of decide what its own priorities are. So for example, because we have a river, a lot of our priorities around stormwater runoff and pollution are much higher than, say, the eco district in Portland, which is entirely in an urban core with no water. So stormwater runoff is still an issue for them, but it's not directly flowing into a river. So it's maybe a little bit less important.
Okay. And do you have neighbors asking these questions? Do you feel like you're getting neighborhood buy-in now?
I do. I actually, whenever we talk about this, one of the first questions I get is, can I live there? And I'm always a little bit surprised by that, because most people don't know that it's a certification process. They don't know. But people are drawn to this idea of living somewhere that is sustainable and eco-friendly. So there's a lot of community interest in the idea that we are on the forefront. You know, if you look at the registered eco districts online, there are all the big guys. It's Seattle, it's Portland, Atlanta, Boston, and then there's Rochester. So we have a lot of people who are in the sustainability field that are excited that we are on the cutting edge of this. And it's also a new model. So in a lot of ways, we're helping them develop what works for communities. So it's fun to be in the sort of innovation phase of something like this.
If you missed it earlier this hour, we'll go back over it soon, what's coming up on Friday, because they've got a lot coming up on Friday. But give me the full year's view. If we're sitting here 1 year from today, what has changed? What has happened in the eco district? What's the progress?
1 year from today, we will have gone through the first step of certification, which means all the stakeholders will be on the same page about what does equity, resilience, and climate protection mean for our eco district. So we will have defined that. We will have written up a document. It will have been sent off and certified. That's all the behind the scenes stuff that you're not likely to see because it's not super exciting to the normal person. We will have installed a pollinator pathway. We will be well into doing our 1,000 tree project, which is a goal to plant 1,000 trees in the eco district and directly around the eco district. We're partnering with the city of Rochester to do that. We are partnering with the American Heart Association to create a heart healthy walking loop in the eco district. So that should be up and going with all the signage accompanied. And this fall, we'll be having another eco fair that will be Skillshare based. So we will be teaching life skills, such as the very simple things like sewing on a button that people may not know how to do, that they could be able to mend clothes, or how to properly cut an onion, the sort of life skills that we're finding are missing. So we're going to have a Skillshare fair this fall.
When you talk about the walking loop, where are we talking there? Do we know yet?
Yeah, so it basically runs from the corner of Mill and Brown, it'll go up the pollinator pathway, because one of the intents of that is to program every part of this walking loop. So it'll go past the pollinator pathway. You will take a right and go over the Smith Street Bridge. You will take another right and cut back down St. Paul past the Genesee Brew House, and then take a final right to come back over the Pont d'Arens Bridge into High Falls.
There's your loop, which runs how long?
I believe it's about a mile.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so that gives you a sense for the next year or so. Let's do this. Let's get a break. And when we come back, we're going to do a couple things. We're going to ask them, Rachel's right to mention that for a while, this $80 million dream was, wow, that's a big number and a big grandiose vision. And now you might just end up becoming part of Rock the Riverway and an integral part. However, Rock the Riverway isn't a done deal yet. I mean, they're still submitting ideas, or the actual submission of a plan happens, I think, in May, if I remember correctly. Producer Megan Mack will tell me if I'm wrong. But, I mean, we're still a few weeks away from that. They've been taking public feedback. And what if these ideas are not really funded in the way you want? Or do you we'll ask if they expect that to be the case, if they've gotten any sort of feedback already. So we'll talk about that. Pamela Reed Sanchez is going to tell us a little bit more about what workforce development might mean, and does it work in a green industry? Our guests are going to talk about green industry jobs. Can we expect that? And what about cheaper energy? Can we expect cheaper energy as a result at any point in this process? And is that part of the eco-district in Greentopia? So a lot to discuss with our guests in studio. Let's get that break, and we'll come right back next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections. You've probably heard about the incident at Starbucks near Philadelphia. Two people arrested. They happened to be black, and they were arrested after not ordering a drink for just a couple of minutes. Well, we're going to hear why this is not an outlier, why this happens more often than we think, and we'll discuss what it means in our first hour. Second hour, a preview of the Rochester Cocktail Revival. Talk with you Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. In our short break there, I was reminded that Lisa Barron is on the advisory board for Rock the Riverway. So basically, the game is rigged for Greentopia. Is that correct?
No.
Okay. Is there any chance Greentopia doesn't get a significant boost in funding through Rock the Riverway money that's going to be decided, we expect, sometime this year, the formal proposal being submitted next month?
You know, Evan, I have high hopes. So the Pont d'Arens Bridge is one of the city's major goals to fund because of its physical state, along with the Carroll Park. The Pont d'Arens is has some serious structural issues that really could, well, they need to be addressed sooner rather than later, or else the bridge could be closed to pedestrians.
It is maybe my favorite. I think it's my favorite spot in Rochester. I really think standing in the middle of that bridge is my favorite place in Rochester.
It's a phenomenal asset. It's a historical asset, and certainly it is the place to be to see the natural asset in Rochester, downtown Rochester, which is a 96-foot high waterfall.
What's it going to cost to renovate it?
There's a lot of numbers going back and forth about that. I think the city is saying just to do the bare bones infrastructure repairs, maybe about $5 to $6 million.
Okay, and so I'm curious to know how you and Rachel would prioritize, because if the overall vision for Greentopia and for the Eco District is $80 million, or wherever the number is now, the state government has committed $50 million for Rock the Riverway, not just for your what you want to do. So how you would prioritize what you'd like to do if chunks of that money come in this year through Rock the Riverway?
Right. So Rock the Riverway invited all individuals to submit proposals for additions to the city's own 28 projects. And so Greentopia did submit a proposal, and it included the Pont d'Arens Bridge. So if you're going to do these basic infrastructure repairs, let's do something really spectacular on top of the bridge and spend, the extra $2 or $3 million out of Rock the Riverway to really do it right, to make it quite a destination in and of itself.
So it wouldn't just look like the same bridge, but just more structurally sound in ways that we can't see. It would look different.
It would look different.
Give us what's the vision?
Well, you can do a lot of different things. You could enhance the lighting. You know, we're the city of optics. We could do some truly artistic lighting on that bridge. We could do, of course, plantings, you know, container plantings. We can change the way the seating and the flow of the bridge is, how it feels, how it's how it functions as an entertainment destination. You could make bump outs on the sides of the bridge where you could have seating and perhaps a venue or a place for yoga on the bridge. Or some other type of programming.
I might start doing yoga if it was offered on the bridge.
Absolutely. What a great place to do that. And it's a connector, right? So at one end you have Granite Mills Park, which is already being programmed by the High Falls Bid with weekly concerts. But there's no stage. There's not adequate seating there. So let's spend maybe the part of Greentopia's proposal was to spend extra money on enhancing Granite Mills Park to be truly an outdoor venue. And then on the other side, you have, of course, the Eco Brewery and the connection with the CSX railroad that the city purchased to increase the trail that runs along the other side, it's already money's being spent and assigned to create enhancements to that trail. Let's take another step forward and maybe make it better.
Okay, you want to add to that?
No, that's pretty comprehensive. Honestly, as long as the Pontarenz Bridge stays open at this point, that's my
priority one.
Yeah, if it closes, that's going to be a huge detriment to High Falls. So making sure that some of the first wave of money goes to maintaining that so it stays open is really important.
Is there an expectation that without any funding or help for Pontarenz, the bridge as is could stay open for another year, 3 years, 5 years? Do we know the answer to that?
I don't have a crystal ball, and I certainly am not an engineer. So I think a year is good. It'll probably stay open. 5 years from now, I'm not sure.
Okay. So, again, a spectacular and important part of the city, prioritized at the top. If they said, hey, we're going to take care of the bridge exactly as you want it, and Rachel, what else do you want? We're going to give it to you from the Rock the Riverway funds. It wasn't just because Lisa was on the advisory board. We think we're going to give you two or three more ideas that have come out of Greentopia and the Eco District. Where would you prioritize it?
I would like to see the current visitor center retrofitted to be a modern ecotourism center so that we could really have a wow experience for people from all over the world who come to High Falls, with education for people who live here, so that when the school buses bring their kids down and the tour buses bring people in, we have a really warm, welcoming, educational, modern experience for people who come to High Falls. I would like to see that done.
Okay, so now you've got some of the vision, and I want to talk to Pamela Reed Sanchez, who's president and CEO of the Seneca Park Zoo Society, about workforce development, because that comes up with some frequency. We talk about green jobs and what that means, and before the program began, you brought up that idea that we could actually be seeing more of that. Is it happening now? What's going
happening?
On there?
We're starting our urban ecologist workforce development program this summer. It's a program that is for teenagers who are rising juniors in high school to make a two-year commitment. Again, it's a paid program. These kids need work. They don't have time to volunteer. And they will become trained in urban ecology. They'll become naturalists for the urban environment and be representing urban ecology, be the ambassadors for their neighborhoods and their peer groups, their schools. We've just joined the Urban Wildlife Identification Network, which is a program run out of Chicago. We're the second organization in the Northeast, I believe, to be a part of it. We'll be putting out 34 trail cameras throughout Rochester in urban public spaces this September and monitoring the urban environment and inviting people to help us crowdsource what we're finding, how close are the coyotes coming in, what's using the space, and the urban ecologists will be a part of managing that program for us. Our dream and our partners in this include, you know, RIT and MCC and St. John Fisher College in terms of accessibility to careers and colleges that are nature-based careers. And what we're trying to do is create a vision for kids who are from the urban core to first be connected to the environment and then see a path for themselves to explore a career in related to the environment or nature-based studies.
How many people are we talking about in
we're
the urban ecologist workforce?
Six in each cohort. So this first year we'll be hiring six, and we're actually partnering with the City of Rochester through Summer of Opportunity to do that this summer. And then next year we'll bring on another six, so that starting this year we'll have six, next year 12, and then 12 each year going forward.
In some ways, you know, when we talk about a green economy, this is under that umbrella, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Because sometimes I think we think of energy industry jobs as the green economy.
You know, for me, you know, I read the statistic and I quote it a lot, that 10 years from now, the seats of power will be occupied by people who are millennials, people who are from the urban core, and people of color. Now, those are obviously not three mutually exclusive groups, but what those three groups have in common is that they are in general disconnected from nature. So if these are the people that are making the decisions about clean air and clean water, or how we're building, how we're zoning, what does that mean for the urban environment? The kids from the urban core tend to have biophobia rather than biophilia. They're scared of nature. And many of them for good reasons, but a lot of it is just that they simply aren't exposed. They're not growing up catching toads in their backyard and counting fireflies like kids from the suburbs and the rural areas are. So they grow up with a fear, and the plan, you know, what we see our role in is to be able to connect them to nature, see the importance of it, and again, explore it so that 10 years from now, 15 years from now, no matter what career they choose, they're making informed decisions that can positively impact the environment. I don't know what's greener than that.
Do you use the term biophobia sort of flippantly, or is it?
No, that's a real term.
Real term.
That's a real term.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and again, to Pamela's point, that's just a lack of exposure. It's a lack of opportunity.
It is, and we see the kids coming into the zoo on school field trips. You know, we had 1,300 second graders from RCSD there this past week, and a lot of times you'll see kids coming into areas of the zoo where we have snakes, and they won't enter the building because they are so terrified. That usually hits around 9 or 10 years old. And whatever we can do to counter that and have people understand the importance of every species out there, not just the cute, cuddly ones. Although I have friends who think that snakes are quite cute and cuddly. So,
who are these friends?
They work at the zoo.
Yes, that's a good idea. They work at the zoo. Is there any sense, Rachel, in the Eco District that job training or focus on a green economy can be a part of it under that umbrella in the future, or is that not part of it?
Yeah, it's
apart from what we're hearing from Pamela.
Yeah, as you may know, Greentopia already runs a green workforce development program over in the Josana neighborhood with our cut flower program. And we've been exploring many possibilities with various partners, from can we get a solar panel recycling green training job down here? Can we, you know, who can we partner with to bring green training downtown where the people are? To actually learn. And I know MCC, who's one of our great partners, is doing a ton of work with job training. So at this point, because we're still sort of in the beginning phase of the Eco District, it'll be very exciting to see which of these partnerships really comes to life in a meaningful way.
When we read the website and some of the work that you've done to educate the public on what your goals are, you talk about things for the Eco District like access to fresh food, reduced energy cost. Are those things achievable?
I believe so. Yeah. There are so many people in Rochester already doing this work. Pathstone is already doing so much work with making houses more energy efficient. And there's programs run out of the Community Foundation that are making them more lead safe. There are things that are already happening, but they're trying to cover the entire city or the entire 9-county region. So the idea is, how can we help make a concerted effort, putting our boots to the ground in this area to make sure that this area isn't sort of lost? Because everybody's at capacity and everybody's overworked. So trying to add that helping collaborative hand to say, what can we do to make sure that these neighborhoods aren't overlooked?
And there are certainly other eco districts in the country. Are they doing this?
They are. The eco districts are very, very different. So every eco district has its own. One is actually just a hospital campus. So the idea of trying to draw parallels from that eco district is very difficult. But some sort of energy reduction or lower energy cost is always a goal.
Where are, by the way, you mentioned it earlier this hour, but again, other eco districts are generally in bigger cities, right?
Generally. I think, if I remember correctly, there's a new one in Santa Monica, which is a smaller city. But yeah, we are on the smaller side of a city having an eco district.
Okay. I think you mentioned Atlanta, maybe?
Yep. Atlanta, Seattle, Portland, Boston, D.C., Denver. And that's
always,
where my memory runs out.
It's always Portland.
It's always Portland.
I mean, you didn't even have to tell me that Portland was going to be on the list. In our last 10 minutes, I'd like to hear our guests hit a couple of other points before we go back to where we started, which is what's coming up on Friday that they want you to know about. This is an area of Rochester that I don't get why it hasn't really taken off, but it really hasn't. And when I first moved to Rochester, you know, about 16 years ago, it wasn't that long after Bill Johnson and his administration had worked really hard, in some ways with tax incentives, to try to develop sort of nightclubs and, you know, entertainment and more down in the High Falls area. And the thought was, why are people not going? But it didn't really work there, and different things have happened. And so when we look at Rock the Riverway, every time we talk Rock the Riverway, we've got some listeners who will say, it's just too spread out. We don't have a centralized waterfront. People aren't going there because it's not organic. You can't force people to go there. Can you change behavior? And you talk about, I think, more of a kind of a stage and for more event space and improving the Pont de Ren. Have you thought about why it hasn't worked in the past? Do you have thoughts about that? And do you think that could change, Lisa?
I think the goal, at least for Rock the Riverway, is one of the first named objective that the board agreed to was connectivity. And when you think about High Falls, you think about how sealed off from the rest of downtown it is and how difficult. It's not a long, I've walked this, it's not a far walk to get from my office on Brown's Race to City Hall, but it seems like it, because of all the concrete, because of the inner loop, because of the fact that, and you know this, people are going 90 miles an hour down State Street, and it is just it doesn't seem to connect with pedestrians or bicycles or the things that other cities celebrate, their walking culture. And
it doesn't feel very walkable.
No.
The distance is not that far.
No.
Okay.
So to spend money on creating a more walkable city, a city that actually thinks and feels comfortable riding bicycles, since we do have now bike share program, a city that actually can go down to the river and touch the water and understand that they can launch a kayak at this new site, that, you know, a floating dock that's there for them to use for free. You know, and that's an operative word. So High Falls, the entertainment district, you had to buy the ticket to get in. What we're talking about creating at High Falls today, you don't have to buy a ticket to enjoy it. You can just walk and ride your bike and be there and experience it.
Okay, so there's two separate but important concepts there. Number one, the cost of entry, which you're going to take away. And number two, you still have to find a way to make the city feel more walkable or more less car-centric, because people still won't go even if it's free if they don't feel like they can get there or safely. Fair enough.
Correct.
Okay, you agree with that?
I do. And I think the trend is just moving. There are so many people in High Falls now, with the brewery seeing its resurgence and how many events they're having in their parking lot and how much foot traffic we're just generally seeing in High Falls, that I think with BB Station having been torn down and the potential for what that could mean for more people living down there and more people having a presence there, so it doesn't feel so empty after 9 to 5 when all the people go home from work. It goes back to my statement about timing. I think people are just seeing the potential more than they have in the last 10 years.
All right, let me get a couple of listener comments. Tom on Twitter, and I'm going to direct this to Pamela Reed Sanchez, who talked about the pollinator pathway and the value of the bees. Let me preface Tom's tweet by saying, I am not an expert on bees, pollination, the state of the bees, the bee die-off, or what's caused it. There have been a lot of different ideas floated. I am not up to speed on the very, very latest on what they think about that. Tom is pointing to an article that I have not read, so sorry, Tom, but he says, are they trying to solve a problem that may not exist? Is the bee apocalypse even real? So what do you know about the latest on that, Pamela?
There continue to be bee die-offs, and the changing weather patterns that we have are seeing, for example, I know, you know, Evan, you and I share some friends who have space in Finger Lakes in the wineries, and they're experiencing bee die-offs earlier in the year. Hives are coming alive earlier, and then the weather's turning cold again, and so it continues to be a problem, and those are some honeybees. But the other thing is that people have, they want these well-manicured gardens, and they mulch everything, and the ground bees don't have a space, which is one of the reasons that we love working with Greentopia on this project, so that there will be space for those ground bees. There are, you know, flowers and plants, and, you know, birds need them as well. This isn't just about the bees. The problem is bigger than the bees, but the bee problem is real.
And I will cop immediately to it. I have had a ground hive nuked on my property, you know, years ago, in my less nature woke phase, but still, you know, I guess that's part of what you're saying, right? I mean, people want sort of perfect
let manicure. The dandelions live.
Let the to put it more bluntly, let the ground bees live.
Yes.
They're important.
They're important.
Okay, so, and
if you want to grow cucumbers and zucchini in your backyard, you need those bees.
So you expect that this pollinator pathway should do a lot more for that. There's a ribbon cutting on Friday. So let's talk about what's coming up Friday at noon at the corner of Brown and Mill Streets, the Arbor Day event in the Eco District. And they're highlighting three different projects. So the pollinator pathway, again, for those who missed it, is what exactly, Pamela?
It is mixed species of both wildflowers and grass that are native to this region. It's a special mix that we've created, and you can actually buy the mix in our zoo shop now in amounts that will either cover 100 square feet or 250 square feet. But it's native species, perennials and grasses that will invite the pollinators back.
Okay. And what else is going on Friday?
We are just kicking off our two major projects for the year, which is the Thousand Tree Project and the Heart Healthy Walking Loop. And the pollinator pathway sits at the intersection of those two because we're planting the trees and programming the loop. So it's sort of a two-for-one project. And we just really wanted to show people that this eco district plan that we just finished up over the last 2 years isn't just going to sit on a shelf. We're really doing projects, and we're doing them immediately. So we're excited to kick off and get some energy going this spring.
Richard wanted to know what kinds of trees.
You're going to have to ask Cardinal Landscape. We have a list that's been going back and forth. They will be flowering trees. So we've talked about tree form lilacs and flowering pears and a couple different options depending on what's available. I didn't really give them a whole lot of notice, to be fair. So we're getting a lot of whatever's available in the 2-inch caliper size. So I will let you know on Friday when we tag them.
Okay. So, Richard, stay tuned for more details on that. And from Adam, let me just go back here just a moment. Just wanted to weigh in and say that it sounds like there is some confusion about poverty and the eco district. People who are living in poverty cannot be asked to think about ecological problems. They have more immediate life-threatening problems in front of them. And Adam just goes on to say he's a little worried about the intersection there, that there may be some dissonance there.
I think this is one of the reasons why I stand behind the holistic approach that Eco District is taking, because it's not, if you look at our priority areas online, one of them is livable community. So we're not just strictly dealing with climate change or energy reduction. It's really a holistic framework to make High Falls more resilient. So we're really doing our best. I mean, it's a complicated issue, as I'm sure everyone knows. It's hard to balance the needs of those in poverty versus with the needs of the earth as it stands with climate change. But this holistic model is really, I think, doing its best to try and balance all those needs at once.
Okay. We didn't use the word the phrase climate change much this hour, and that's a whole separate discussion. But Pamela, how do you see that intersecting with our discussion today?
I think that there's definitely a link between the anti-poverty initiatives that we need to undertake and the role that the environment and understanding the environment can play in that. I don't, you know, a lot of people say conservation is a luxury. I'm not, but the truth is we all can be conservationists and live more sustainably and be able to afford things. You know, if we can teach people how to do community gardens and have access to, you know, get rid of some of the food deserts that we have, which I know Greentopia has been working on in the Eco District, that's a win-win. That meets the needs of the community members that live there to have good, healthy food, and it helps get them involved in it and learning, and it's good for the environment. So,
yeah, I take Adam's point, and I think the spirit of it is right. But I think what I'm hearing from the Eco District this hour is it's a different approach. It's a lot of different things that are happening, and it's not telling people in some of the most impoverished neighborhoods, recycle more. It's instead going to the neighborhood saying, we can actually cut your energy costs. Pathstone and other groups have already started that. Here's how. Here's how we can cut your costs, but also provide, you know, better, cleaner energy. Here's how we can educate families that just want to come down and visit who do want to learn about urban ecology. So different things happening at different times, I think, from what I'm hearing. And we hope you'll keep us updated. Where online can we learn more about the project and the vision here? Best place to go?
Greentopia.org.
Greentopia.org. And Lisa's had this smile on her face as you seem optimistic.
I have an invitation. So the next public session for Rock the Riverway is May 1st from 4 to 6 p.m. at Rochester Riverside Convention Center. I encourage you to come and speak out.
And you're running out of time if you want to do that, because we're going to see some more formal proposals submitted within the next month or so. So May 1st, where is that?
Rochester Riverside Convention Center.
And thank you for being here. That's Lisa Barron, Board Chair for Greentopia and Advisory Member on Rock the Riverway. And thank you, everyone from Greentopia. Pamela from the Seneca Park Zoo Society, nice to see you as well.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
And they'll see if you want to go out Friday at noon, corner of Brown and Mill, for the big kickoff there. Thanks, Tim George, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow.